to this is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you're listening to CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
This week on Wings, the topic is Rosa Luxemburg, one of the most influential political theorists of her day. She lived from 1871 until 1919, when she was assassinated by the newly elected socialist government of Germany. Luxemburg had written that socialism by gradual reform of the capitalist-oriented system would never provide for the needs of the workers, that only revolution could do the job. She was strongly in favor of the innovation of May 1st as International Labor Day. In many countries, it's still a national holiday, but it originated as a day for workers across the globe to stop work and show their collective power. Rosa Luxemburg's life was complicated, but one author boiled it down to a popular book, in fact, a graphic novel. Here are excerpts from an interview with the author of that book, Kate Evans, courtesy of Mitchell Cohen of Community Radio WBAI in New York City.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
So who was Rosa Luxemburg?
Well, she was tiny. She's 101 years older than me, which means she was born in 1871. She's a Jewish-Polish woman. She's only about 4'9", as far as I can work out. And she has a terrible limp, sort of crippled hip. Her family are not poverty-stricken, but they're Jewish, and anti-Semitism's really bad in Tsarist Poland. She's a woman, you know, how is a woman meant to make an independent living for themselves in the 19th century? She decides to be a socialist, and socialism is illegal. And she completely overcomes all of these obstacles, and she becomes a professor, and a journalist, an editor, a lecturer, and an uncompromising theorist of how to make society a better place and what's wrong with the economic systems that we have. She was a very good abstract thinker about economics when people weren't really using terms such as gross domestic products or globalization or the military-industrial complex. But from first principles, thinking really hard about the way economics works in society, she came up with some really strikingly original analyses of exactly what's wrong with capitalism and how it then fuels imperialism and globalization and war. There's not very much biographical information about Rosa Luxemburg out there. What there has been, it's been quite poorly written. We're lucky to have her letters, which are sparkling, and some of them are incredibly poetic. She has loads of different lovers. She goes to amazing places, and she has amazing hair. I mean, it was fun.
Most of us in my collective at Stony Brook University back in the late 60s and early 70s, Rosa Luxemburg was our hero. We read many of her political writings, especially the mass strike pamphlet and Reform and Revolution. You quoted from her the same quote that I always use. It's not like picking sausages from the counter of history.
Now I'll quote her back at you. You see, I've learned from history that one should not overestimate the impact that one individual should have. I mean, maybe she shouldn't be your hero, but through learning about her story and through writing her story, I was writing the history of a large social movement. And I don't think I had at all realised how incredibly organised and powerful international socialism was, how much it achieved in the really solid work that 19th century activists did in trying to create a better future.
The way you drew it, this is a book that's not just her words. Your creativity and your imagination in every panel shows all sorts of things that you're assuming went on or projecting went on.
The job of the graphic novelist is to make the story interesting. I build on the historical facts. So you know this guy, Ebert, is going to become president of the Weimar Republic. He's a socialist, and it's just incredible that the people rose up and overthrew their government and put him in charge. So I know he's in the party school, and she's teaching in the party school. He's the student. So I add an imagined conversation between the two of them, which draws out the differences in their approach. I mean, Ebert famously says after the German Revolution happens, "I hate revolution like a mortal sin." And that's a very, very different conceptual position from Rosa Luxemburg's. So I introduce a conversation between the two of them just to heighten the dramatic tension and to set up, who is this guy? So at the point when he's elected president, there may be slightly a foreboding sense of this social uprising may have gone off the rails at the point when he's been put in charge.
Especially what happened in Rosa's life a month later.
Yeah. The situation is there's a revolution in Germany in November 1918, which I didn't even know. And I studied that subject at school, that particular history. And they didn't say there was a revolution. They said, and then there was an armistice and the World War ended. Not the World War ended because people overthrew their government, which is a bit of a detail to leave out. So then the socialists are in charge in Germany, and then Rosa is a revolutionary socialist leader. So the fact that she gets murdered by her own government is a movie-scale epic betrayal and something of incredible historical significance. I was reading the history books and then I was going, she just got killed by her own people. That's just, oh my God. And it's amazing to be given a story that has so much inherent drama within it, even though I did have to read a hell of a lot of really boring revolutionary socialism to bring it accurately to life.
Such as what?
Oh God. Well, you studied Rosa Luxemburg as your personal hero, so you probably went through all those really dense texts happily. Maybe there wasn't any Facebook at the time to distract you. It's really hard to get Rosa Luxemburg and break it down into little tweetable quotes. She writes lengthy passages of prose, and some of it is really focused and dynamic and descriptive and poetic, and some of it just goes on and on and on for pages about, for example, other economists whose work I don't know and who aren't relevant. She's talking about the building blocks of economic theory that's got her to where she is now. But what I'm interested in is what relevance her work then has for us now.
Could you give a little bit of the mass strike?
I summarised the mass strike down into a picture of Rosa putting a bedspread over a bed in 1905 Warsaw.
Well, that was important to us when we went through the Occupy movement and in other movements that seemed to just emerge without the leadership of any particular party.
Ah, yeah. The mass strike does not produce the revolution. The revolution produces the mass strike. What she's studying is a country in turmoil. 1905, over half of the European workers in Russia go on strike. There was a demonstration on the Winter Palace. Over 200,000 people march on the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg to petition the Tsar, and they're asking just to be recognised, that the poverty and the hardship that they're going through is recognised. And the demonstration is fired upon by the troops, and hundreds of people die. And it just galvanizes the country. And the form that activism takes is the mass strike. People down tools and they walk out. And over half the country is on strike. This has parallels with the Arab Spring in Egypt, which also had a mass strike element to it. What's interesting about it is that's not a strike that's being called with a ballot and by a union. And then Rosa was living in Germany. She couldn't live in Russia or in Poland because she would have been arrested immediately, whereas Germany, she had some political freedom to be a socialist. And so she's dealing with trade unions and party political leaders in Germany who are saying, well, when shall we call a mass strike then? Or, well, it would be irresponsible to call a mass strike. And she's going, you don't call a mass strike. Mass strikes happen. This is what happens when there's a tipping point where people come out on the streets, where they realise they have to say it now and they have to say it in person. And one of the ways you do that is by stopping work. And one of the ways you do that is by public protest. And now with social media, we have other ways, more horizontal ways of organising as well. It's really interesting to see how the spontaneity that she's talking about in 1905, how relevant that is when messages can spread so quickly. The mass strike cannot be called at will. It cannot be made, planned, or decided. Spontaneity plays a great part. And she says as well, it's like you don't have the mass strike and then that's just one thing. It's part of a movement. She's got a lovely sort of sense that she embraces ambiguity in her writing, which is refreshing because things aren't black or white.
You have a much better explanation in the book about how everything contains its own opposite within it that propels it forward.
We're talking about dialectics here, aren't we? The best bit, I think, of the mass strike, she says, it's a bit of pulsating life of flesh and blood, which is connected with all parts of the revolution with a thousand veins. If sophisticated theory purposes to make a clever dissection of it, It will not perceive the phenomenon in its living essence, but will kill it altogether. And you could see that maybe if you want to talk about Occupy. Are you talking about the events of one day in one street with one set of people? Or are you talking about the significance of Occupy for a movement and a time and a place that is lived by a million different people in a million different ways?
There was a big fight within Occupy movement here in New York and the U.S., and especially in New York because all the leftist groups are headquartered here, that we need a program for Occupy. So there was one section of Occupy that formed themselves into a working group, and they were trying to push everybody else into creating a program, voting on leaders, and that was sort of ignored by a lot of the other people, but it created an interesting tension in the group.
Oh, yeah, well, maybe you could form yourselves into ists on either side of that. You could be a leaderist group and an ignorist group, and then you could have a big fight. Honestly, I look at the history of 19th century socialism. I do just want to bash their heads together and say, can you not just have some conflict resolution training and sort it all out so we then don't have to have the 20th century and fascism and all of that rubbish? While I think Marx's analysis of capitalism is amazing, and I'm proud to be able to try and popularise that for people who don't have any understanding of the structural problems with capitalism and the possibilities so we can have a better system that safeguards our future and that of the environment and the planet. What we need to do is look intelligently at what the problems are with capitalism and work out how to tackle them on every level and with every strategy. And if we start going, well, I'm a this-ist and you're a that-ist, you're creating walls instead of building bridges.
Do you live in England now?
Yeah, I live in the West Country. I'm a cartoonist. I started as an environmental activist, doing cartoons about the activism that I was involved with. I wrote a book in the 1990s about the Rhodes protest movement, which involved us all living in trees and getting evicted using cherry picker hydraulic platforms. It was crazy, crazy lifestyle.
Did you actually live in a tree yourself?
Oh, yeah. I lived in a tree. Yeah. I think it was really funny now. I mean, now I'm like just taking my kids to school and back and going, I actually used to live in a tree.
How long did you live in a tree?
Well, I had a few different trees. There was a tree that was my tree, which is now... It's an open cast coal mine in South Wales. It was a beautiful, beautiful woodland, water meadow, little glen with this little twisty oak tree. So that was kind of my tree. That got chopped down in 1996. And then there was another road that was built in 1998. And I used to sleep in a hammock at the top fork of a branch of a beech tree, 70 foot up. I just look at it now, God, we were nuts, in a fun way. If there's any young people out there wondering about whether to get involved in activism, get involved in activism, because you make lifelong friends with such sound people. I wrote cartoons giving the personal stories of the people who were involved in the movement, making the political personal and helping people to connect with it in that way. From then, I've moved to various different subjects which have inspired me to write books. I've done one about climate change. I've had children. I've written books about breastfeeding and about birth and about choices within birth. Quite interesting writing about parenting because you can't really make rules. You can't really have a right and a wrong when you write about babies because you always have a baby who will confound you. That's been good for me personally about embracing ambiguity.
On Wings, you are listening to Kate Evans, creator of the graphic novel Red Rosa, about the life and ideas of early 19th century socialist theorist and labor activist Rosa Luxemburg. Kate is talking with Mitchell Cohen of Community Radio WBAI in New York.
I was offered this Rosa Luxemburg biography opportunity, and it was my first biography, my first historical graphic novel, the first time that I've try to do anything quite so ambitious in terms of drawing, because it's 179 pages and it's drawn throughout. And the first time I got to really play about with narrative and with structure so that I was creating a work of art based on a person's life. Start with her birth, finish with her death, but also to convey the meaning of what she was writing about in its historical time and its relevance for today.
And if I must say, it's an absolutely brilliant book, both artistically and for a beginner.
Hopefully the fact that it's a graphic novel will make it more popular for people, because people like to read comics. That's why I do what I do. Especially if you can get a bit of humour and you get a bit of drama and get a bit of, you know, life into a story. I mean, I wrote a whole comic format book about climate change. And that is a tough subject to make funny. But again, I used a narrative. I had sort of three main characters and a conversation going between the three of them so that you've got a personal focus for a story and you can have a bit of drama and you can make things funny. That's not too difficult to do with Rosa Luxemburg because she just has some excellent one-liners. There's a bit where the leader of the party is like really worried because she's turned up late to dinner. And he goes, oh, we feared you were lost. It's her and her friend Clara Zetkin. And she goes, oh, really? Imagine the epitaph. Here lie the last two men of social democracy. So basically massively dissing all these male socialist party leaders going, we're the only men here, me and my female friend.
Well, that's one of the things that we missed when we were reading Rosa Luxemburg for her political economic analysis. We knew she was one of the few visible women in the socialist movement, even though the movement was filled with women.
The one who's left a written trace, which means we can re-examine who and what she was. It really helps that Verso has brought out a collected edition of Rosa Luxemburg's letters, and a lot of them are her writing to her lovers. Four different lovers? Yeah. She has a few of them at the same time at some point. And she's talking about what inspires her emotionally and day-to-day events. So you can find out the most lovely little details, like she would save wasps if they got trapped behind a window pane. She would climb up on top of a stack of books and open... She was tiny, remember? She had a limp, remember? She would open this top window pane and send wasps on their way. Or if she found a little beetle in the grass, she would pick it up. And she'd write letters which I think are almost unsurpassed in the beauty of the poetry of the way in which she approaches life. And a lot of them she writes when she's imprisoned indefinitely for opposing the First World War. The strength of her character, to be able to experience such joy and to be able to convey it so poetically when she was in such a dark place, I just think it really shines through. Not only is she trying to do good with her life, not only is she being a really intelligent, indomitable, formidable woman in the face of all these multiple oppressions, but she's also just really funny and really poetic and really beautiful with it. And that's just such an amazing thing to then be able to put the pictures to. There's a beautiful letter where she's writing about an encounter with some water buffalo, which I particularly enjoyed because I never got to draw water buffalo before, and it's always nice to be able to draw different things. I found one little quote about a fly. With every fly that one carelessly swats and crushes, the entire world comes to an end. In the refracting eye of the little fly, it is the same as if the end of the world had destroyed all life. So that's the basis of her respect for other living beings. So I contrast that in the book with some of the quotes that the other people were making about her, because she was a hate figure in the German press at the time because of her ethnicity and because of her gender. She was Bloody Rosa. So the German people are unable to understand why an end is not put to the impertinent behaviour of this female. I put that as the next quote in the book, being, while she's revealing how amazingly empathetic she is. Some of the sexism that Rosa Luxemburg experiences is just jaw-dropping. There's a letter between a couple of prominent Socialist Party leaders. One of these guys, August Babel, is he's written a book called Women Under Socialism, which is an early feminist tract. Okay, so he says, "Dear Rosa must not be allowed to spoil our plans. I shall see to it this ridiculous call for a republic will be relegated to obscurity." He sounds like a Bond villain already, yeah? To which Vix Adler says, "The poisonous bitch will yet do a lot of damage. She's as clever as a monkey, yet her sense of responsibility is totally lacking."
These were actual quotes?
These are actual quotes, and I give the actual sources at the back of the book as well, because I think it's really important that people know that all the way through the book, I'm not making up the words that are coming out of people's mouths. These are things written in a letter, so I change the context, so I show them coming out of their mouths. But it's lovely to have that kind of degree of textual authority while you're creating a script. Yeah, the poisonous bitch will do a lot of damage. She's as clever as a monkey. So, right, the next page. I have Rosa starting to talk about some of the major ideas behind her masterwork, The Accumulation of Capital. So she's chatting to her cat and she goes, "Mimi, I'm as clever as a monkey." My historical interest in the subject's been piqued now.
There's a biography of Marx came out a couple of years ago. It's the best one that I've ever seen, by Mary Gabriel. It's called Love and Capital. She reconstructs the Marx family's life as an affinity group. She found this trove of thousands of their letters to each other that were buried in a vault in Moscow, and she had them all translated. Nobody else had seen them, and she was not a Marxist. She was a Reuters reporter, and it's just wonderful.
Well, the Eleanor Marx biography sounds like it covers similar ground, because it talks about Marx's family relationships and wider family, and then centres her youngest daughter, Eleanor Marx, in the middle of it, and then she goes on to experience horrendous domestic abuse, which Rosa Luxemburg does as well, actually. That's an interesting parallel. She has 14 months of sustained stalking by Leo Jurgisches. Rosa Luxemburg's romantic encounters are really interesting, and I set this up in the book. It's like boy meets girl, boy and girl fall wonderfully in love. They've met each other's soulmate, and then you watch the relationship go sour. You watch the ways in which that they're emotionally incompatible with each other. And then he gets sent to prison for 8 years, to Siberia. He escapes. He keeps escaping from Siberia. Amazing guy, Leo Jurgisches. But in the meantime, she's started a relationship with her best friend's son, Kostya Zetkin, and he's 14 years younger than her, which I think is quite remarkable at the time.
You didn't have what Clara Zetkin thought of that.
I kind of think Clara Zetkin had a problem with it, because Clara Zetkin had a much younger husband herself and had faced down social opprobrium for having a much younger lover and had shaken that off. So I don't think she was about to give Rosa Luxemburg a hard time for it. But then, like, if you're going to get into the gossip of German socialists, so we've got Karl Kautsky, yeah? He's a prominent theorist, and he's the editor of Die Neue Zeit, the Marxist theoretical national periodical, yeah? So he's a big cheese, and most biographies, I'm sure, would just concentrate on him. The interesting person is Louise Kautsky. Rosa Luxemburg's friends with both of them. Apparently, Louise Kautsky was really in love with Karl Kautsky's brother. So Rosa Luxemburg encourages Louise and Karl Kautsky, she's got children with Karl Kautsky, yeah, to live in this apartment block where the brother's on one floor and Karl's on the other floor with a different apartments, and so she can live with both of them. I mean, they really practiced their freedoms.
Did that actually occur?
Yeah, it did.
And Karl Kautsky went along with that?
Yeah. I think it was all about freedom in all kinds of ways. I mean, we think everyone was doing it in the 1960s. They were doing it in the 1905s as well, the noughties.
I always thought his first name was Renegade, because Lenin always called him that Renegade Kautsky. For years, we thought that was his first name.
He's not that much of a renegade. I think he's one of those theoreticians who can tie themselves in knots justifying anything. I mean, at the point when the First World War
breaks out. That was the big break in the international and the German party.
He turns around. Okay, so the whole principle of international socialism is that working class people make connections with each other, and that they work on their common cause, and they overthrow the oppressions that they all have together. And the First World War is where that completely falls apart, because you have the working people of one country running into the machine guns of the working people of another country. It's an absolute travesty of the whole principles of socialism. Karl Kautsky turns round and says, "The international is not an effective weapon in wartime. It is essentially an instrument of peace." And Rosa Luxemburg is extremely scathing about that. She's like, instead of the Communist Manifesto saying, "Proletarians of all countries unite," she says, Kautsky would rewrite it, "Proletarians of all countries unite in peacetime, but slit one another's throats in war." I mean, the idea that Kautsky could turn around and go, "Oh, yeah, no, socialism was really important, but now we're at war, it's not so important." Luxemburg had the purity of vision to oppose the First World War as part of capitalism and part of imperialism from the outset.
Now, the only one in the German Reichstag, or the parliament, who stood up against World War I and Germany's participation in it was Karl Liebknecht. There were no women in the parliament then, in the Reichstag.
Luxemburg couldn't vote. She couldn't be elected to parliament. In a way, that actually gives her the freedom to oppose what's going on more straightforwardly, because she had nothing to gain by trying to become popular, because nobody's going to vote for her, because they couldn't. So she was sort of able to keep this purity going. But yeah, Karl Liebknecht is the guy who is the only man in the Reichstag to oppose the First World War. He doesn't do it the first time, incidentally. When they first vote for war credit, it's unanimously in support. But he turns around in December the 2nd, 1914. He's the only guy who stands up in opposition to the votes for war credits.
And he was rewarded by the German government, the so-called socialist government that existed then, being murdered along with Rosa Luxemburg.
Both of them are murdered. I mean, their story is known together. I don't tell Karl Liebknecht's story in particular because I'm just focusing on Rosa Luxemburg. They drop him at the hospital saying, oh, he was shot when he was trying to escape. This is Rosa Luxemburg on the First World War, and I'm reading it to talk exactly about what the First World War was. So it's 1915. The war's been going for a year. Mass murder has become a monotonous task, and yet the final solution is not one step nearer. Capitalist rule is caught in its own trap and cannot ban the spirit it has invoked. Gone is the first mad delirium. Gone are the patriotic street demonstrations, the singing throngs, the violent mobs. The show is over. The curtain has fallen on trains filled with reservists as they pull out amid the joyous cries of enthusiastic maidens. We no longer see their laughing faces, smiling cheerily from the train windows upon a war-mad population. Quietly, they trot through the streets with their sacks upon their shoulders, and the public, with a fretful face, goes about its daily task. Into the disillusioned atmosphere of pale daylight there rings a different chorus, the hoarse croaks of the hawks and the hyenas of the battlefield. 10,000 tents, guaranteed according to specifications, 100,000 kilos of bacon, cocoa powder, coffee substitute, cash on immediate delivery, shrapnel, drills, ammunition bags, marriage bureaus for war widows, leather belts, only serious propositions considered. And the cannon fodder that was loaded onto the trains in August and September is rotting on the battlefields of Belgium and the Vosges, while profits are springing like weeds from the field of the dead. Business is flourishing upon the ruins. Cities are turned into shambles, whole countries into deserts, villages into cemeteries, nations into beggars, churches into stables, popular rights, treaties, alliances, the holiest words and the highest authorities have been torn into scraps. Hunger revolts in Venetia, in Lisbon, in Moscow, in Singapore, pestilence in Russia, misery and desperation is everywhere. Shamed, dishonoured, wading in blood and dripping with filth, thus capitalist society stands, not as we usually see it, playing the roles of righteousness, of order, of ethics, but as a roaring beast, as an orgy of anarchy, as a pestilential breath, devastating culture and humanity. So it appears in all its hideous nakedness. The Unionist Pamphlet, Rosa Luxemburg, 1915.
Kate Evans is the author and illustrator of Red Rosa, a graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg, published by Verso Press. She talked with Mitchell Cohen on Community Radio WBAI in New York. Their conversation has been edited to fit our 29-minute format. Evans is a longtime cartoonist. You can find her graphic fiction and nonfiction books on the website cartoonkate.co.uk. UK. That's all one word, cartoonkate.co.uk. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose online events can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. A video featuring the gift of community radio will be recorded for that site on May 4th, 2024. For more information, email wings@wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to present the Project XT Trio, featuring Kevane Wayne Space, better known as R.P. Boo, the legendary pioneer of Chicago footwork, DJing, Seymour Wright on saxophone, Paul Abbott on drums. Taking place Sunday, May 19th, 5 p.m., the 40th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoria. For tickets and more details, visit fimav.qc.ca.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
Help us spread the word. CKUT is looking for someone to join our team as the chair of the board of directors. Our board of directors reads the fine print, approves the annual budget, engages in community outreach, and keeps CKUT's eye on the bigger picture. The board meets for 2 hours every month, and the chair circulates agendas, keeps meetings organized, and acts as a liaison between the outside world and the board. If you're passionate about the station, this is an opportunity to help lead CKUT into a new era of community media. For more information, please send a message to admin@ckut.ca.
Hey, yo, what's up? This is Usher chilling on CKUT 90.3 FM, baby. Out.
That's coming from grassroots level.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamarani, and on today's Making Contact.
By the late 1930s, by the early 1940s, it was perfectly clear that to create a Jewish state in an Arab country would require the dispossession of a very large proportion of the Arab population. And that's what happened in 1948.
We talked to Rashid Khalidi about his new book, The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance.
Israel has created a situation where no one is going to be able to take control of Gaza and where there's likely to be continued resistance in the West Bank for an indefinite period.
Stay tuned. All that and more coming up.
Past week, mainly over the week, and Israel has intensified its strikes, air strikes, on various parts of the territory, including the southern, the middle, the northern Gaza Strip, as well as Gaza City, which has been...
Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamarani. You're listening to the voice of Rami Almagari. Rami has reported from Gaza for decades for Pacifica Radio and for us here at Making Contact.
As the Israeli army has stormed already the Al-Shifa Hospital, which is a major hospital in the Gaza Strip, where a few thousands of people have been stranded there, including patients.
Rami was forced to flee his family home in northern Gaza when the Israeli bombing began. And for a while, he was sending us audio reports of the situation around Palestine.
In fact, other developments in Gaza have been unfolding coincidentally as Israeli airstrikes have hit...
This one is from November of 2023.
For the third time, the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza Strip, they hit nearby the hospital, around the hospital.
Rami, like many Palestinians, is effectively now a refugee on his own land. Over 30,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli troops since October 7th, and Gaza is currently the most dangerous place on earth to be a journalist.
That is the situation on the ground in the Gaza Strip for the time being. Rami Almagari for Making Contact, Gaza Strip.
If you've listened to most of the Western press, the focus is on October 7th as the beginning of the war. But the war in Palestine started decades ago, before October 7th, before the Intifadas or the Camp David Accords, even before World War II. And if we really want to understand what's happening in Gaza right now, we have to understand that very early history, which is when Zionists first set their sights on Palestine. And to be honest, it wasn't a history that I knew all that much about. So I sat down for an interview with Rashid Khalidi.
I teach at Columbia University, where I'm the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies.
Because I just read his book, The 100 Years' War in Palestine, And Rashid said he had some specific reasons for writing this book. First, he wanted a more accessible account of Palestinian history, so not so academic. But he also wanted to combat some misconceptions.
I had a very strong thesis that this is not a conflict that's been going on since time immemorial. It's a conflict caused by imperialism and the rise of modern nationalism. That there was no hostility between Arabs and Jews before the rise of Zionism and of modern Arab nationalism, and the intrusion of British imperialism into the Middle East after World War I. And finally, that Israel, while it represents a national project of Zionism, was established as a settler colonial project, and that those two things are actually not contradictory.
And for today, we're going to focus on a pivotal piece of Palestinian history, the very early Zionist movement, and the subsequent settling of Palestine with the help of the British and later on the United States. And we hope that today's interview will help us to understand how we got to where we are today. Rashid, to start, let's talk about the idea of Zionism, because for many of us in the modern world, we've come to perceive Zionism as a decolonial movement or even an indigenous one. But you argue in your book that actually, in the beginning, Zionism had no problems calling itself a colonial endeavor, and that Zionists even aligned themselves with the big colonial powers of the time. So talk to me about Zionism as a colonial movement, and then how it rebranded itself into a decolonial one.
Absolutely. I mean, the founder of modern political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, made no bones about it. At one point, he said something like, "We'll be a barrier for Europe against the barbarism of Asia." So they saw themselves as Europeans, persecuted in Europe, but nevertheless European. And they described what they were doing in terms of colonialism. I quote Zionist leaders in the 1920s. I quote in particular Zev Jabotinsky, who's the founder of probably the most influential trend in Zionism since the 1970s, the revisionist trend, which, you know, fathered the Likud party, which has dominated Israeli politics for the last 40 or 50 years. And he was quite explicit in talking about this as a colonial endeavor. He was quite explicit in talking and understanding that any colonization necessarily produces resistance by the indigenous population.
Jabotinsky argued in an article written in 1923 that Arabs would never peacefully cede their land because no indigenous people have ever ceded their land to colonizers without a fight. He even explicitly compared Zionism to the kind of settler colonialism seen in the Americas.
And the fact that people dodge and weave around the idea of this project being a colonial one means that they're completely ignoring the writings of people like Herzl, the writings of people like Jabotinsky, and the self-perception of the early Zionist movement. One of the most important land purchase agencies was something called the Jewish Colonization Agency, later rebranded as the Palestine Jewish Colonization Agency. It existed until 1958. So that was not just how other people perceived this, Palestinians or other Arabs. That's how they perceived themselves. I mean, they saw they had a claim to the land. They believed their claim, you know, entitled them to do whatever they wanted. And they intended to establish a Jewish state in a predominantly Arab land on the basis of that claim, but operating as a settler colonial project. Now, what happens in World War II, which is the beginning of the era of decolonization, is a switch by the Zionist movement. Having been backed by the British up until World War II, in an era where colonialism and settler colonialism were in good odor in the world. I mean, the League of Nations and the great powers considered colonialism a good thing. And so Zionism had no problem in self-identifying as a colonial movement. But the Zionist movement fell out with the British after the British changed their policy in 1939. And from that point on, when they were in conflict with the British, they began to see themselves as an anti-colonial movement and to rebrand themselves and sell themselves as anti-colonialists who struggled against British imperialism. British imperialism established the Zionist pre-state. British imperialism made possible an increase in the Jewish population of Palestine from about 6% to 31% between 1917 and 1939. So the idea that this was not the spoiled stepchild of colonialism and British imperialism is absurd. But that rebranding was very successful in the era of decolonization.
So do you think that, I mean, yes, it was a colonial movement from the jump, but do you think that all of the early Zionist settlers realized that they would have to violently crush the Arabs in order to maintain land?
Not at the beginning. I think there was a lot of self-delusion. In his diary, Herzl wrote that we will spirit the poor population across the borders discreetly, so that they understood that what they were trying to do was an embarrassing thing, to remove the indigenous population. But they intended to do that. Now, he said, spirit them across the frontiers, implying that that could be done easily, presumably with bribery or other inducements.
Early Zionists might have been optimistic that the indigenous Arabs that they were displacing would calmly move out of their homes and off of their land. But the idea of benevolent displacement didn't last long, if it was even real in the first place. Of course, the Palestinians resisted and began fighting back.
They understood that as Jabotinsky wrote in that 1923 article, the objective was to transform Palestine into the land of Israel. And that meant their dispossession. This is pictured as the irrational Muslim hatred of Jews or some other absurd fashion. But in fact, it was, as Jabotinsky pointed out, this is the natural resistance of an indigenous population to a colonial project. And so over time, the more hard-headed Zionists, like David Ben-Gurion, who later on became the first prime minister of Israel, recognized that forcible removal of the population, the euphemism that was favored from the 30s onwards, was transfer. What it meant was expulsion and ethnic cleansing, dispossession, would be necessary. So by the late 1930s, by the early 1940s, it was perfectly clear that to create a Jewish state in an Arab country, in a country that as late as 1948 had a 65 or 66% Arab majority, would require the dispossession of a very large proportion of the Arab population. And that's what happened in 1948.
1948 was the year of the Nakba, which we've covered a lot here at Making Contact. The Nakba, or the catastrophe, was the mass displacement and ethnic cleansing of Arabs living in Palestine in order to make way for the state of Israel.
You couldn't have done what Israel did in order to create a majority Jewish state, failing, you know, the kind of massive immigration they had been hoping for in the 20s and the 30s. The Jewish population as a proportion of the whole increased, it's true, from 7% to about 31% by 1939, but that wasn't a majority. And so force was necessary.
Yeah, and I mean, sort of relatedly, I've heard Netanyahu in the past talking about Arabs in some pretty racist ways, and this is far before October 7th, much as colonial empires view the people that they're subjugating. And so there's this contradiction sometimes in the way that Zionists talk about themselves as being indigenous to the Middle East, and yet viewing the Arab world as inferior and barbarous.
Well, I mentioned Herzl talking about a barrier against the barbarism of Asia. I mean, that idea that we are Europeans and we represent enlightenment and they are non-Europeans and they represent darkness, if you want, was, how should I say, extremely widespread among Europeans. That was the worldview that European Jews shared with other Europeans, a racist view based on a sense of superiority over the natives, over the indigenous peoples.
Right. And that's also interesting because there were already Jewish people living in Palestine, but they weren't, I guess, European Jews. There were Jewish communities who were predominantly Arab in culture. Is that right?
That's correct. Most of the Jewish population of Palestine were, in fact, Mizrahi Jews, Eastern Jews, either indigenous Jewish populations that had been there for enormously lengthy periods of time, sometimes have always been there, or other immigrants to Palestine from places like Yemen or other Arab countries, as well as many Ashkenazi Jews who had come for reasons of prayer or study or pilgrimage and who had stayed. And so you had a non-Zionist, in many cases anti-Zionist, Jewish population. The majority of the Jewish population of Palestine right up to World War I probably fit into that category. The number of European Jews who came there for political reasons inspired by Zionism were still probably a minority as late as World War I. And you're right, as far as Arab Jews were concerned, whether in Iraq or in Palestine or in Syria or Lebanon or elsewhere, generally speaking, they shared the culture, the language, the cuisine of their Muslim and Christian neighbors. They spoke Arabic. They were separated by religion, obviously, but they shared the same culture, generally speaking.
So, Rashid, we've covered some of the early ideals of the Zionist movement in terms of its colonial aspirations. But the early Zionist movement was small, and colonizing an entire territory requires a lot of arms and money. So talk to me about how Zionists began seeking out colonial funding or colonial backers. And I'm especially interested in why the British decided to support Israel so strongly.
The primary reason was strategic. The British, since early in the 20th century, had been worried about the defense of the eastern frontier of Egypt, which was a vital stepping stone on the route to India. And the empire, the crown and the jewel of the empire was India. And so control of the Suez Canal, which runs through Egypt, was absolutely vital strategically to the British Empire. And British planners and strategists and generals and the Committee of Imperial Defense were all worked up by around 1905, 1906, with the problem of the defense of Egypt from the east. And Palestine, as the country to the east, was the focus of their concern. The other important strategic factor is that Palestine is at the Mediterranean terminus of the shortest land route between the Mediterranean and the Gulf. And in that same period, the British were realizing that the building of a railway would enable transport quite rapidly between Europe and the Mediterranean and the Gulf and the Indian Ocean. And they wanted to control that shortest land route, just as they controlled the Suez Canal, and for the same reasons. And so when you look at the Sykes-Picot partition frontiers of 1915, 1916, you see a strip of land running from Palestine across to Bosnia under British control, which is the, how should I say, the instantiation of that British strategic priority that Britain must control not just the shortest sea route, but also the shortest land route. That's the reason they were interested in Palestine. And the Zionist movement came along and they developed a transactional relationship. We will support your project in exchange for our using that as the pretext for our being in Palestine. In the words of a British official who was actually the first military governor of Jerusalem, a man named Sir Ronald Storrs, what Britain was trying to establish was a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of hostile Arabs. And I think that sort of sums it up.
We're about to head into a break, but stay tuned. We have a lot more to discuss with Rashid Khalidi about his book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. We're just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, please visit us online at radioproject.org for show links and behind-the-scenes information, or to leave us a comment. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamarani, and today we're talking about Rashid Khalidi and his book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. In the first half of the show, we looked at the early Zionist movement as a colonial endeavor and how the British became its primary benefactor. Without its help, Israel would not exist today, or at least the mass migration to Israel that slowly displaced the Palestinians could not have happened. However, although Israel still received support from the British government, the United Kingdom is not Israel's primary supporter. That, of course, is the United States. So, Rashid, Great Britain had been a huge supporter of Israel. What happened? Why did Great Britain lose interest?
Well, this is before the establishment of Israel, but the Jewish Agency, which had been established by the British as a sort of quasi-government, Zionist quasi-government of the Jewish population of Palestine, switched because the British had switched. And the British switched for reasons linked to the original strategic reasons that had made them want to control Palestine. By 1939, they had had enormous difficulty in mastering a massive nationwide Palestinian revolt that had lasted from 1936 to 1939, which had required the sending of over 100,000 British troops and police to Palestine, and which had cost a fortune to the British exchequer, and had only been suppressed with the greatest difficulty. Between 14 and 17% of the adult male Palestinian population were either killed, wounded, interned, or arrested, or exiled. And the British realized by 1939 that they were on the brink of World War II. There was a restive Arab population in Palestine. There was fury and rage throughout the Arab world, and in fact, far beyond in the Muslim world, including in India, about what Britain had done in Palestine. And the British realized we're going to have to fight in the Middle East. We're going to have to fight Mussolini. We're going to have to fight Hitler. They could see the war coming. And so Britain changed its policy. It had to cater to Arab sentiments. It had to cater to sentiment in India. Secretary of State for India and the Viceroy are writing the cabinet and telling them, this is an Indian problem now. What you are doing in Palestine is a problem for us in India. They could not send Indian troops to quell the Palestinian uprising because they couldn't be sure of their loyalty. There was so much support and sympathy for the Palestinians in India. And I think that's an indication of the strategic reasons for which Britain changes course. And in 1939, issues what's called a white paper, in which they limited Jewish immigration, which had been unlimited up to that point. They limited Jewish land purchase, which had been unlimited up to that point. And they shifted for the first time to talking about an independent Palestine, which would have had an Arab majority. And there were all kinds of poison pills in this, which meant it probably never would have taken place. But from the Zionist perspective, this was a betrayal. The Zionists always read the pledge in the Balfour Declaration of a Jewish national home as a Jewish state. And in fact, Lord Balfour and Lloyd George and Churchill had assured Weizmann that that's what they meant when they said a Jewish national home. They meant when you have a majority, you take it over, it's yours. And so they, in their disappointment and in their anger, you had the beginning of a rebellion in the Jewish community in Palestine against the British, and a search for new patrons. The Zionist Project needed a new patron. They tried the Germans and the French before World War I. They had succeeded with the British during World War I. And during World War II, they managed to find two exceedingly powerful patrons, which were the United States and the Soviet Union. And those are the powers that ended up backing the establishment of Israel through a General Assembly resolution in 1947.
At the time, the United States was not the global power that it is now, but the U.S. already had a deep interest in Zionism.
The main motivation, I would argue, was electoral and strategic for the United States taking the approach that it did after World War II. The United States wanted a foothold in the Middle East. The United States wanted to ease the British out and take their place. The United States was very impressed, in particular, once the Arab-Israeli War started, with the military prowess of the new Israeli army. And so whether it was oil companies or the Defense Department or others, as well as the president, who had his own electoral concerns, different parts of the U.S. government saw alignment with Israel as advantageous to the United States. Truman famously once said, before 1948, to a group of American diplomats who were serving in different Arab capitals, and who said to the president that he should moderate his support of Zionism, he said, "Gentlemen, I have many constituents who are concerned for the success of Zionism. I don't have any who are concerned for the Arabs." And that was an electoral consideration for a president who barely got elected in 1948. And so that for him was a factor, as it was a factor for LBJ, Joe Biden. You cannot ignore the electoral importance of this issue for certain important segments of voters and certain important segments of donors, especially to the Democratic Party, but now also to the Republican Party.
Yeah, you know, when I was reading that section about how the U.S. became interested in Israel, what really stood out to me was how good the Zionist movement was at reading the global stage, courting Turkey, or I guess at that time the Ottoman Empire, Great Britain, and then knowing or seeing that the U.S. was becoming a huge colonial power and easily sort of wooing American politicians. That's something that the Palestinians just weren't able to do very easily.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the shrewdness of the Zionist leadership before the establishment of Israel and of Israeli leaders since then in sensing shifts in the global balance of power is really quite remarkable. Of course, it's a function of the fact that they understand that the project is dependent on outside support. You cannot establish a Jewish state in a majority Arab country and keep that Arab majority out and hold them down and resist support for them by their Arab neighbors unless you have massive external support. They have to be sensitive. They had to be from the moment of the establishment of modern political Zionism, and they have to be today during the Gaza War extremely sensitive, at least to the support of the United States and the former colonial powers in Europe, who are in effect the metropole of this colonial project, the center. Without that center, Israel is a powerful independent state. It has nuclear weapons. It is the fourth largest army in the world. It's technologically superior in many ways. It has a huge army. We're seeing four divisions in Gaza, several divisions along the Lebanese frontier. How many armies have 8 or 10 or 12 divisions? And yet it is dependent. Shape, were it not for American vetoes in the Security Council. The Israeli artillery would not have shells to fire were it not for the United States. And so this remarkable prescience and concern about the international balance of power is a function of the absolute dependence of the Zionist project, and since then, of the state of Israel, on external support, specifically from the United States and Western Europe.
There's a lot more in Rashid Khalidi's book, The 100 Years War in Palestine, and you can find links to his work on our website. But we wanted to end here because right now, for the first time, the colonial backing that Israel has normally depended on is under threat.
We are here today because we are absolutely disgusted by our government's involvement in this genocide. And yes, it is very much a genocide when every single member of your community has lost multiple family members.
We're speaking to each other at a time of terrible anguish in Gaza and in Palestine and among people who have any kind of moral sense. There seems to be no end in sight.
Protests around the world have reignited an interest in Palestine and the history of the Zionist movement there.
Clash overnight between police and protesters blocking one of Australia's biggest ports. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators targeting an Israeli ship docked in Port Botany in Sydney.
It doesn't really matter what anybody on this stage says today, because the greatest message that could be delivered is from you, the tens of thousands of people who came to this city in the greatest show of international solidarity that Ireland has seen in many years.
There have even been open allegations of genocide against the Israeli government. So to end, we want to talk about what that means for the region.
I think that Israel has sowed the seeds of a disastrous situation for itself in terms of more intensive occupation of the West Bank, intensification of colonization of the West Bank, and what will inevitably be a reoccupation of Gaza, I think. Israel has created a situation where no one is going to be able to take control of Gaza from Israel, and where there's likely to be continued resistance in the West Bank, probably armed resistance in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip for an indefinite period. Whatever happens militarily, whether Israel succeeds in defeating the armed resistance in the Gaza Strip, it won't end resistance there. There's no way it can do that. In fact, it's probably generated a whole new wave of people who will rise up against the occupation. 75,000 people have been killed and wounded so far. I mean, there are 20,000 people dead. There are 7,000 or 8,000 people missing, most of whom are dead. There are, I believe, around 50,000 people wounded. So we're talking about 75,000 people, and the war is nowhere near over. We could have many, many more killed and wounded and maimed and missing. And that will generate enormous anger and hostility among Palestinians for a very long period going forward.
The numbers cited by Rashid are from late last year when we first talked. That number is a lot higher now. And it's also important to note that Israel's long-term strategy is unclear. But one thing is certain, and it's something that Jabotinsky pointed out in that 1923 article we mentioned at the beginning of the show. Whether or not Hamas is overthrown, the war will probably create a bigger, stronger, and more determined resistance.
Where that leads, I don't know. What the impact of that on the Arab world is, I don't know. You have in the Arab world regimes that are based on repression of what their people want and not allowing them to express themselves. Most of these regimes, whether they're absolute monarchies or whether they're military dictatorships, are terrified of their people. And the fact that public opinion in the Arab world is extremely deeply affected by what's happening in Palestine is a wild card. You have in Lebanon and you have in Yemen and you have in Iraq forces that, and in Syria, some forces that are, you know, militarily engaging in this war to a limited extent. But otherwise, Arab regimes are quiescent. They're trying to do things diplomatically, but they're ineffective. How that will work itself out in the future, I don't know. Finally, you have the United States and Western Europe, which are the, you know, the metropole for this project, which are the allies of Israel and are the absolutely essential backers of Israel, without which it would be in a parlous situation. How this war will affect support for Israel in these countries, again, it's impossible to say. And there seems to be a trend in the United States and at least in Great Britain towards a deeper sympathy for the Palestinians and towards a greater unwillingness to give Israel the kind of blank check that American and British and European governments have traditionally given it. how that will work out is impossible to say.
And however it does work out, we'll continue to follow the war in Gaza here on Making Contact for the rest of this year. That was Rashid Khalidi talking about his book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, and that does it for today's show. If you'd like more information, to leave a comment, visit us online at radioproject.org. I'm Salima Hamrani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Too soon that fire.